from KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Everyone thought, wow, that's going to be cool. But it's like, we're not a bank. How do we justify that on our books?
The idea behind Richard Linklater's latest movie, Boyhood, is brilliant but risky. Follow a child over the years as he grows into young manhood. Linklater tells us how he convinced a cast, a crew, and a single investor to sign on for this daring 12-year endeavor. And later on the show, Linklater gives us an update on Bernie Tita, the convicted murderer who inspired his film, Bernie, who is living above Linklater's garage. But first on the news banter, Time Warner spurns an offer from Rupert Murdoch's media empire for now, and Microsoft gives up on original programming. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my fellow banterer, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Kim.
So, gigantic news in the media world. Rupert Murdoch jumps up with an offer for not some little something-something, but Time Warner.
Yeah, to the tune of $80 billion. Yeah. Time Warner rebuffed that initial offer, but what Rupert wants, he usually gets. And eventually, as we saw with the Wall Street Journal, what we've seen with several properties through the years, if at first he doesn't succeed, he keeps on going until he does.
Yeah. In fact, that while Time Warner is now considered to be definitely in play and very possibly to be acquired eventually by Fox, and their stock is up, the Fox stock went down a bit because of investors nervous that Rupert is so determined to get what he wants that he will overpay, as he may have done, for example, with the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, and there's talk of Time Warner being ultimately bought for as much as $105 billion. But this is an interesting company. Jeff Bukas, ever since he started running Time Warner, it turns out really has been prepping this company for a sale, stripping assets like AOL, like Time Warner Cable, and of course, most recently, Time Inc., getting rid of those
pesky newspapers and magazines. Those legacy properties
that
are not with value.
Not a print scone. Suddenly Time Warner is looking awfully pretty, and it's time for News Corp to pony up.
It's just unbelievable, though. You know, we've talked about the likelihood that the herd will thin as the environment changes in the entertainment world, but he didn't go for some little something. You know, Warner Brothers is the most successful studio by many measures and has been for years. It's hitting a little bit of a rough patch this summer, but, you know, Harry Potter and Christopher Nolan movies, and on the television side, Big Bang Theory and Two and a Half Men and, I don't know, help me, Mike, with these gazillion shows.
Right, right. Well, you know, Rupert obviously is not a young man anymore. And if he's going to make a big deal, he's got to come out guns a-blazing. This is his last hurrah, perhaps. And so why not
aim for the...
Exactly. He may live forever. But, you know, aim high. And that's what he's doing with Time Warner, obviously. And again, you could see where some of these assets actually work together. Fox doesn't have a premium cable network. HBO, obviously, at Time Warner, is the grand dam of them all. You've got two news networks, of course, and Fox News and CNN, but if you jettison one of those, of course, CNN being
right,
the one you jettison.
That's the one they've identified,
yeah,
yes.
Then, you know, you're fine, and you've got some great cable properties that work together, and, you know, there's no broadcast network at Time Warner, so you've got Fox, FBC over at News Corp, and you can see where it might work.
This is the kickoff of something that's going to go on, as, you know, a lot of people like, who's next, what's next? We should note that Time Warner Cable, that acquisition by Comcast has yet to be approved by the feds and is being scrutinized. A lot of people complaining that it's too much, too big. But so far, it doesn't feel like there's tremendous vigor on the part of the federal government when it comes to the antitrust considerations.
Not at all. Not at all. These deals always eventually make their way through somehow. There's some sort of concessions. But ultimately, I mean, as you saw when Comcast purchased NBC Universal, you make nice with a couple of people and bam.
And meanwhile, also at Fox, which was big potatoes until it was turned into smaller potatoes by this other thing, Kevin Riley, who's been a guest on our show a number of times, who just proclaimed the death of pilot season about a few minutes before the end of his career as the head of programming on that network. He exited, was pushed out not long ago, and there was a sort of a pause. And the two people who have long run the production part of Fox, Dana Walden and Gary Newman, finally were announced as the two new heads. They're going to run the production studio that makes shows, as well as a network that may be I don't know, buying a lot of the shows that Fox will then make and own.
Right. This is a return to form for Fox. So once upon a time, the studio and the network were under the same head. But then there have been several years where the studio and the network have not operated together. And as a matter of fact, it's caused a lot of tension. Fox hasn't necessarily picked up a lot of 20th shows. And 20th has shopped a lot of their best shows to other networks.
Modern Family.
Thank you. Is at ABC, a show that Fox would have loved. And vice versa, there are no new 20th Century Fox TV shows on Fox's fall schedule. So there's been no love lost there. The irony, of course, is of all the vertically integrated studios and networks, Fox was the first. Fox Network was created solely to air 20th Century Fox TV shows. It just hasn't worked out that way. But now with Dana and Gary in charge, that could all change, and they'll probably start to fall in line with what's already happening at CBS, ABC, and NBC, which is studio network working together under the same umbrella.
And I'll just note as we close up here that Microsoft, which had promised to do a lot of original programming along with, it seems like, everybody and their brother, you know, with along with Amazon and Netflix and
PlayStation
others. Yeah.
And YouTube and of course, Yahoo.
So after a lot of time with the engine kind of idling, and a very high-level executive, Nancy Tellem, who was hired when after having left CBS, nothing. They're shutting it down.
No, and what's amazing is it was just a few months ago at the New Fronts, as they called it, in New York, where
this
Xbox—
is the gathering where they sell not broadcast or cable television, but alternative television. They try to woo advertisers
right.
to their programming.
And that was the big coming out party for Xbox Studios. Nancy Tellem and her lieutenant, Jordan Levin, who used to run the WB network back in the day, unveiled their big, ambitious development plans, very network-style plans. But obviously, this has all been put on hold with their new CEO and with massive layoffs going on at Microsoft in general. They announced 18,000 people are being laid off. This was just something that wasn't going to be in their plans going forward.
Yes, and the chief executive who you mentioned, Satya Nadella, said the single biggest digital life category is gaming. So that's where they're going. Thank you, Mike.
Anytime, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Writer and director Richard Linklater is the mind behind a diverse oeuvre of films, including Slacker, Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, as well as Before Sunrise and the sequels Before Sunset and Before Midnight. Some say his latest film, Boyhood, is his masterpiece. The premise is simple. Follow the life of a young boy and his family over the years in real time. Almost every aspect of this venture depended on luck. Linklater found a very patient backer willing to give him a budget of $200,000 a year for 12 years. For the child, he chose an unknown, Eller Coltrane, and really could only hope that this little boy would stick with him to the end. He cast his own daughter, Lorelai, as Eller's older sister, and recruited Patricia Arquette to play the mother. Linklater's frequent collaborator, Ethan Hawke, plays a once-absent father who reappears in his kids' lives. The film begins with Arquette's character packing up her kids, Mason and Samantha, for a move from a small Texas town to Houston, where she hopes to build a better life.
Goodbye, yard. Goodbye, crepe myrtle. Goodbye, mailbox. Goodbye, box of stuff Mommy won't let us take with us, but we don't want to throw away. Goodbye, house. I'll never like Mommy as much for making us move.
Samantha, why don't you say goodbye to that little horse attitude, okay? Because we're not taking that in the car.
Goodbye, old lady. Listen to rock music and ride the motorcycle.
How did you talk to investors about this? You know, investors, normally, they like to be paid. So how did you say to them?
Yeah. Or let's say be paid within a 13 year, before 13 years goes by.
Exactly. Exactly. So what do you tell them?
Well, I got lucky. Jonathan Searing at IFC, you know, I threw out this idea and he got this look and he's like, you know, that sounds really cool. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it's a low budget feature, but at the end of the day, it'll be something totally unique. I think he just liked it. He went with it. I mean, it's still, he gave us a couple hundred thousand a year. I was shooting on film, you know, paying union minimums and all that. But it was really rare that you get that kind of support for something that on the surface not only feels experimental, but feels like a risk. You know, it's a huge leap of faith.
Right.
That it could happen. And Jonathan was there at the end. He's still there. He's distributing the movie right as we speak. So it's kind of amazing that in our industry, I mean, I've been at studios where the studio who greenlit it, the people there aren't there by the time you're even finished shooting.
That is a common scenario.
I think you would predict that myself and my cast would probably still be around 12 years from now, but I don't think anyone would have bet that the executive at the studio, in this case IFC, would still be there 12 years later.
Now, how many different investors are there involved in this? Do you know? Did you have to pitch to different people?
One. No, just IFC. You know, they're within a big conglomerate of media companies, and they had to take a long-range view. They have a library, there was cable stations, and it was the right company to work with because they can think in long-term.
The rarest of things, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you didn't think about going anywhere else.
No, I mean, I floated the idea past a couple producers I had worked with, but they really had no idea what I was talking about. Their eyes kind of glaze over and they're like,
Really?
What?
I'm a little surprised because it's
what
such
are you talking
a,
about?
It's sort of genius, but they didn't say it's genius?
I thought so.
Yeah.
I thought so. No, it's not like they didn't think it was a good idea. I'll give everybody credit on that one. Everyone thought, wow, that's going to be cool. But it's like, we're not a bank. I don't know how to justify that on our books. It doesn't make sense as an investment, I guess.
You know, your movies have this deceptive quality of seeming improvised when they're not. So how much did you reveal? When you told these producers and eventually, you know, IFC, what your idea was of the plot, and how much did it morph while you were making the movie?
In 2001, when I'm actively going around talking about, I want to start making this film, I don't think there was anything on paper. It was strictly me saying what it was going to feel like and be and what the possibilities were and, you know, talking about the trajectory maybe of the adults. So there was a pretty firm structure in place, but there wasn't, you know, the year-to-year details. That was the fun part, to work those up year-to-year.
Yeah. So, and I also read that you incorporated some things that were going on in the real lives of these kids, which one of whom is your daughter.
Yeah, that's easy. It was very natural for us to work together on this, really. She wanted the part and I was like, yeah, okay. And I knew where she'd be every year, you know, because there's a certain volatility
right.
to actors moving away or losing track of. And
was your daughter you knew from the jump that you were going to put her in it?
Yeah, I mean, really, once she realized there was a part for an older sister, the kind of annoying older sister, she was in the age of who I would be looking for. I think she just made it pretty clear to me that she was going to be playing that part. She had been in my film Waking Life. She had grown up on film sets. She had known Ethan ever since she can remember, since she was 9 months old. So she just really saw herself in here. And that's kind of who she was at 9, 10, 11, you know, in those years.
How did you handle the extravagant demands, though, when she wanted, you know, all white M&Ms in a jar in her trailer and stuff like that? I mean, what did you do?
No, it was always, you know, everyone, this was such a low budget. It didn't even feel like a film, you know. It really didn't. There was no expectations. There was no authority on the set. There was no release date. We didn't have a distributor at the time. It was just kind of this thing we did every year, and there was no pressure or expectations. So we existed in our own little world for so long, till the very end. No one was ever the prima donna. I was kind of hoping the kids wouldn't come to realize, like, oh, hey, before I film this year, I need a new car or something.
Right, I was wondering.
We were definitely open for extortion. We were vulnerable to that.
But yeah.
But it never quite happened, so.
Well, stepping back to the assembly of it, how much was, you know, the discussion with the backers of this, with the IFC, how could you assure them, like, I think this kid is the right kid and I think he won't grow up to be, you know, horrendously weird and yeah. unappealing? I mean, you really picked one with this kid.
Well, it'll be a film about a horrendously unappealing teenager at some point.
Yeah, that would be different.
How a cute, smart, thoughtful, sensitive kid becomes a monster. It would be a film about that.
A little darker, yeah.
It was going to go where he went.
I mean, did you tell them, like, the kid promised? What did you tell his parents? I mean, how did you sort of nail it down to the extent that it could be nailed?
Well, obviously, you're kind of casting the parents here. They're making a life decision for their kid that they're allowing him to be involved in this with the thought it will be a good thing in his life. I just hoped it would be something fun to do. But yeah, you're really casting the parents. And in Eller's case, you know, they're both artists. His dad's a musician, his mom's a dancer, and they kind of got it.
I mean, he was already working. You wanted a kid who had worked, right? And he had done commercials.
Yes.
And...
Yeah, I thought that was important. I wanted to have a kid who had already kind of hung out their shingle as an actor, even at that young age, because that kind of indicated a certain kind of family support for this undertaking. This was never a gun to anyone's head. It was like, it was always like just some fun Eller was looking forward to every year. It never felt, even though we had all kind of committed informally, non-legally, I mean, we never even thought about it.
You didn't get contracts for the cast to say, like, you didn't lock them up like Marvel for every possible iteration of the sequel.
You really can't. I know studios are very good at that, options and contracts, but you can't contract anyone for more than 7 years for anything, which is a good thing.
I mean, with Eller, did you say, well, like, I would prefer if you don't work on other stuff while you're doing this film? Like, if he had started to be a thing by some random chance outside of your film.
You know, that never really, yeah, like, hey, here's the kid who's been cast in that movie, and he ends up on a TV show for 7 years, and then, and here he is now in a movie he started before he was famous. Yeah, I mean, that could have happened, but personally, Eller was acting, and he started acting less and less in other things as the years went by. He really just kind of quit going on auditions. He said this was his part. You know, he really just liked doing this every year.
I was wondering, I was trying to visualize you and Ethan and Patricia, like, as Eller turns into this very charismatic young man, kind of stepping away and high-fiving each other, like, oh my God, look at this kid.
it happened so incrementally, you know, that it was really not toward the end. I mean, he's just Eller I'm just working with, but I step back. And I remember just editing maybe the second to last year's footage. And I said, you know, he's just grown into this really interesting looking guy. You know, I just was kind of taking it for granted.
Yeah.
But like, guy, he has kind of rock star, movie star good looks. He's such an interesting, but that's kind of who he was. Yeah, Ethan kind of started saying that at the end. Who knew he'd grow up to look like James Dean? I mean, he's like a young, you know, it's like, well, I guess we won the lottery in that way. But, you know, that was the instinct upon casting him. It's like, well, he's the interesting way to go.
I thought I read there was a point where he started thinking maybe he didn't want to do it. Did I create that in my head?
No, Eller never wavered. He claims that he had a little teenage apathy in there somewhere, but I never remember that at all. He felt like he was the constant. He was always like, yeah, okay, let's get together, let's talk. And he always had ideas, and he grew into more and more of a collaborator. I think he had a very different experience, or let's say orientation to being in a movie than my daughter did, who had grown up on movie sets, and this is just the world she's been in her whole life or around, and I don't think she sees it as some big deal. On the other hand, I think as my daughter, she could also approach me a year where she maybe wasn't in the mood and go, you know, Dad, can my character, like, die? You know, she just didn't want to dress up 1 year in a certain way. And I was like, no, that'd be a little dramatic.
Well, you know, as the parent of a teenage girl, and we do sometimes go through short periods when they think we're complete idiots and they're a little rude and disrespectful.
Short periods?
I was trying to soft soap it there, but I'm trying to visualize you're on the set, or if it were me, and you're telling your own teenage daughter to do something and they just get the eye roll.
No, I never, ever got that.
Oh,
I think there was
really
such a
rare.
I got that perhaps in life, and her mom got it a lot more than I did. But you know, as far as this film and Samantha, and it sounds boring, but it all worked according to plan. The best version of what I could have imagined 12 years ago actually came to pass. It happened the way it was imagined, and it sort of worked. I don't know any other way to put it.
And in fact, though Boyhood is only playing in a few theaters, it's already broken even. Coming up after a short break, Linklater talks about why he's still willing to work within the studio system sometimes. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. As Richard Linklater shot his newest film, Boyhood, over the course of 12 years, you see the characters age, fashions change, and technology improve. Given all that could have gone wrong, Linklater says he's lucky it turned out so right. He even got the music he wanted without breaking the bank. Well, I was going to ask you about the music. There's a very distinctive soundtrack on the film. Big artists like Coldplay and Wilco, Arcade Fire, and Black Keys, and those are expensive. Very expensive.
Yeah. Almost in every case, we had some relation. I used some music that I felt I knew somebody or knew somebody who knew somebody, you know. I'd met Jeff Tweedy before, Black Keys, my music supervisor, Randy Poser. We reminded them that they had got a payday from us on School of Rock 10 years ago. And they're like, oh, okay. You know, so we kind of had personal connections to a lot.
So they gave you a little bit of a better situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's one of these things you can kind of structure now that it's not like it used to be where it's just a lot of money up front. Mm-hmm. It's a certain amount of money up front. It's not nothing, but it's gauged on back end. When the numbers hit this, there's another. So if the movie does a certain amount, they'll have gotten what they would have. You know, it's pretty loaded heavily to a back end, but it's pretty exact, so.
You know, I hadn't thought of music people as profit participants. I don't know how usual that is.
Well, they are here. So.
Now, School of Rock, was that the last studio film you made?
No, I did The Bad News Bears with Billy Bob Thornton at Paramount just a few years after that.
Do you think in terms of I'll do a studio movie every once in a while, but not too often?
No, I'm kind of always have my antenna out there for the right project, you know, the right story to tell. You know, some need studio budgets or have studio budgets. And over the years, obviously, the studios have kind of changed in what they're looking to do or what they can even bother with. So it's kind of a more rarefied entertainment. You know,
I mean, do you sort of have to gird your loins, so to speak, when you do studio movie because it's the studio?
No, I've always had kind of good creative. I mean, another thing I'm always on the lookout for is a situation that's not going to be intolerable
right.
or anything compromised. When I do a studio film, I treat it just like I would any indie film. I really do. I want to have that same approach, the same creative experience, the same working methodologies. It's just at the behest usually of a film that for various reasons has to cost more.
Well, do you find as the studios have become, you know, comic book and franchise obsessed that there are fewer people having that conversation with you among the studios?
Yeah. Yeah. Less and less. But I get sent things constantly. Mm-hmm. And I take it serious. I'm happy to be in the position I'm in where people think, oh, you've made some funny movies, so maybe you'd be good at this. I'm looking for that marriage. But that's not, you know, less and less. It's at a studio level. There's this world right under that. Equity financing, there's some companies involved, and, you know, maybe it's not like the $30 million studio comedy, but maybe it's a, you know, $15 million, you know, I don't know. There's this nether world there that this financing is always a little...
You sort of slosh around in.
Sketchy, and I've been burned in that area quite a bit or just wasted a lot of time.
And the money didn't really materialize.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not really real. There's so many people in our industry who are just sort of kind of faking their way through, so
it's so frustrating. I've known so many people who have spent years on a thing that were this no money at the end suddenly.
Yeah, that's the norm. There's so many people who I don't know how they live or what they do for a living, but they sure kind of put themselves out there as real, and they often have some cred behind them. Somebody thinks they're real, maybe an agency or, you know, I don't.
It's one of the remarkable things about Hollywood. You can't really tell who's really a player. You just are.
I wish there was some kind of accreditation process. You know, like, isn't it in the business world? It's like, oh, you want to talk to me about purchasing my $80 million? Like, you have to show a financial statement or something
right.
before you get in the room. But only in Hollywood, in the arts, where you can kind of just BS your way and you don't know what game they're really playing. They're like, oh, well, because then if I get you to commit, then I'll go raise the money.
Right.
I'll fake it like I have the money. But
right.
then if you can get this star, then I'll...
And I'll run out there and hope for something to fall in my lap.
Yeah, it's so crazy. It's insane. But I mean, I have good people around me who are there to keep me out of those waters, but damned if you don't end up in them sometimes anyway.
While Richard Linklater was filming Boyhood over the course of years, he was working on other movies, among them Bernie, starring Jack Black in the title role. The dark comedy tells the true story of popular small-town Texas mortician Bernie Tita. In 1996, he shocked the community by shooting and killing a wealthy elderly woman who had been his constant companion. Tita was sentenced to life in prison, but after serving 17 years, he was released this past May. A judge concluded that he could be freed if certain conditions were met, among them that he find a place to live. Well, I have to sort of apologize in advance, but I feel this interview cannot be complete unless I ask you about Bernie.
I'm in this Bernie sidebar, no matter what is going on, because
sure,
it's such
true.
It's an unusual sounding story, and the way that got put out there, like, judge orders convicted murderer to live with film director. And that's so, as if I didn't offer my garage apartment, as if I wasn't a part of this whole process of him being released. You know,
Were you just maintaining contact with Bernie and saying, you know, you could live in my garage apartment?
Yeah. You know, I was involved with the, you know, a lawyer is taking an interest in his case. And
this is,
you know,
Jody Cole you're talking about?
Yeah. Jody Cole, an Austin attorney, a very good one, who's kind of come aboard the Bernie case. Like, well,
she saw the movie,
that?
Right?
And
she said,
saw the movie, but she wanted to, like, what was the reality? So I remember I took her the transcript of the trial, and she starts doing more research, and she, you know, she take Bernie's her new client. I mean, Danny Buck Davidson, who Matthew McConaughey plays in the movie, is really the guy here who looked at new evidence and
turned around,
kind of reconceptualized his whole thinking on the case. You know, his job as a DA is to pursue justice and wherever that takes him. And that changes over time. You know, so Bernie had been in 17 years and he sort of saw it in a new light, given a lot of new information.
Have you had any blowback? Like people saying, are you crazy? And he killed somebody?
No, it just sounds funny, but there's a lot of people behind bars who've given a little of attention. I think ultimately Bernie was the beneficiary of the film. I mean, the film's not an activist film. It doesn't end with a free Bernie thing. You know, I just think a lot of people who know the reality of that case feel like he was over-prosecuted. Like his sentence was probably, if you know the spectrum of sentencing, from if you look at it from involuntary manslaughter all the way to first degree premeditated murder.
Right.
And Bernie, I felt it wasn't that. He wasn't some psycho killer guy. It was one of these, if there is such a thing as temporary insanity or definitely a,
like an abuse syndrome.
Yeah, something. It was definitely with circumstances. You know, clearly it was a episode. And he's not a psychopath. He just isn't. So I think the only blowback we got were, you know, it's from the, you know, who is the most loud in our culture? It's the ignorant, you know, the people who don't really know the details of the case.
Right.
If they knew what the judge knew, what the DA knew, what all our, you have to have some faith in our legal system ultimately. I mean, it seems pretty arbitrary, but, you know, look at the case. And anyone close to the case has no problem with it.
Richard Linklater is director of Boyhood, Bernie, School of Rock, Waking Life, Dazed and Confused, the Before trio of films, and many others. Thank you so much.
And others.
Many
Thank
others.
Thank you. Always good talking to you. Yeah.
Thank you. Richard Linklater's film Boyhood is out now in theaters. You can hear an interview with AMC Network's CEO Josh Sapan about funding Boyhood and other projects like Mad Men, Breaking Bad, and Walking Dead at kcrw.com/thebusiness. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.